This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's John Dalrymple Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see johncast.net.
My name is Isaac, and welcome to today's JODcast. We have Benjamin with us.
Hello.
Benjamin, please tell us a little about yourself.
I'm a long-time JODcaster, although I haven't been on for a while. I'm a postdoc here at John Dalrymple Bank. I mainly work on pulsars. I'm here to do your worst with your questions. Let's see what happens.
Our first question comes from John Morrell. And here it goes. As a part of the response to how long will we survive without the sun, in the December X-ray edition, a scenario was described where a passing brown dwarf ejected the Earth from its present orbit to become an interstellar wanderer. My question is, who would be the first people to detect the change in the Earth's orbit and how? My thought is that it may be pulsar astronomers who detect that the distance to the solar system barycenter has increased, resulting in pulses arriving earlier or later.
Yeah, so I think that's correct. So just to do some quick sort of jargon busting here, the solar system barycenter is the center of mass of the solar system. So although the position of the center of the solar system is at the center of the sun, the mass of the solar system isn't distributed in such a way that its center is at the center of the sun. And Jupiter is the biggest contributor to this. And in fact, the center of mass of the solar system, or solar system barycenter, if you prefer, is near the edge of the sun in the direction of Jupiter, wherever that may be at a given time. Now, when we time pulsars, we measure what time a pulse from a pulsar arrives at the observatory, and we immediately calculate what time that pulse would have arrived at the solar system barycenter. And the reason we do this is that the Earth is rotating about its axis, and so we would measure a different pulse arrival time depending on whether our observatory is moving towards the pulsar in one half of the day or away from the pulsar during the other half of the day. Mm-hmm. And so to mitigate this effect, we effectively time pulsars from the solar system barycenter rather than from the site at which the pulse arrival time was measured. Right. So in order to do this properly, we need to know where the solar system barycenter is at any given time. Mm-hmm. We have models of this that we rely on when we time pulsars, and these models themselves rely on us knowing the positions of the planets in the solar system at any given time. So you can imagine, if the Earth's orbit suddenly changed, we'd notice that very quickly, because the signature of the change would appear in pulsar data, because the distance from the observatory to the solar system barycenter wouldn't be what we expected it to be. So we can think a little bit about what this signature might look like. So let's say the Earth is pulled a small way towards the constellation Cetus, for example. All of the pulses from pulsars in the direction of Cetus would arrive earlier than expected because the radio waves haven't had to travel as far to the Earth. But all the pulses arriving from the other side of the sky, roughly in the direction of Virgo, they would arrive late because we're further away now from those pulsars. But the pulsars off to the side at right angles to these two constellations would still be arriving on time because our distance to those pulsars hasn't really changed. So whether or not the pulses arrive late or early depends on their position on the sky and the direction that we've been pulled in. So the technical term for that is that it is a dipolar signature because you have a measurement that depends on where you're looking in the sky. And the fact that we're observing a dipolar signature would give us a clue as to what happened. Either the Earth has moved or we've miscalculated the barycenter in some way. So the first thing that we might consider is, are the clocks that we use to time the pulsars actually running properly? You can imagine when there's a leap second, if we don't add that leap second to our clocks, all pulses from all pulsars, wherever they are on the sky, would suddenly start arriving 1 second early. And we call this a monopolar signature. And one of the things I work on actually is trying to exploit this monopolar signature in pulsar data to create a version of terrestrial time that's based on pulsar timing. So yes, if the Earth's orbit was disrupted slightly, I think it probably would be the pulsar astronomers that noticed first. But given how unlikely this is, it might take us a while to diagnose because we'd be looking for other sources of error first. But determining whether the change is dipolar or monopolar would be the first clue as to what had actually happened.
Oh, yeah. Well, the other question is from John Morrell also. Here it goes. With reference to the jod byte glitches in the rotation rate of the crab parser, that was in June and July 2010, how about monitoring the optical pulses in addition to the radio pulses? It should not need that a large telescope, but would need a high-speed photometer to resolve the pulses.
Yeah, so this is an interesting comment that addresses the sort of radio chauvinism, as it were, that contaminates most discussions of pulsars. So pulsed emission from pulsars is generally seen at radio wavelengths, but in fact, pulsars as a phenomenon are broadband. They're seen across the entire electromagnetic spectrum, from radio waves through optical all the way to gamma rays. Most pulsars are radio pulsars. Some gamma ray pulsars are radio quiet. Some neutron stars don't appear to be pulsars at all. At the very least, they're not beaming in our direction. So observing at these different bands can tell us a lot about the emission of pulsars, because the radio emission is thought to come from quite low altitudes, whereas the high energy emission, such as the optical, likely comes from the upper reaches of the magnetosphere, the magnetic field of the pulsar. And this type of emission probably comes from interactions between a pulsar's magnetic field and a load of charged particles that are streaming away from the surface above the polar cap. So only a very small handful of pulsars have actually been seen to emit in the optical. The Crab was the first one of these to be identified in the late 60s. And the Wheeler's optical pulses were discovered around a decade later. So that tells you how difficult these optical pulses are to actually find. And in fact, the Crab pulsar is the only pulsar bright enough that we can actually see the individual optical pulses. And the MAGIC telescope in La Palma does long-term optical timing of the Crab. For the other optical pulses, you need to have their data folded for the optical pulses to become observable. So you count the number of photons you receive on a photometer every few microseconds or so. And if you already know the rotation period of the pulsar, you can fold the data at that period and form an average pulse out of all the single pulses. All the noise cancels out, the pulses add up, and you're able to see the pulse clearly. And observatories that time the Crab in the optical get the exact rotation period at any given time from radio observations, usually from Jodrell Bank. We release a monthly model of the Crab pulsar's rotation because it's the pulsar that by a very, very long way we pay the most attention to. So optical timing does happen for a few pulsars. It's no way to do high precision pulsar timing though, because the fluxes, that is the amount of energy under each pulse, is very low. We're still very dependent on radio timing for that.
Okay. Well, that question is from Kat Thays. As I understand it, when a neutron star collapses, it conserves angular momentum and gets an enormous spin, seen by millisec pulse rates. Does a black hole do the same? How do we test this?
So white dwarfs and neutron stars do rotate, and they rotate by virtue of the fact that the progenitor stars that resulted in their existence also rotated. Angular momentum is this measure of the amount of rotation a body has, and it's related to the mass of the object, its size, or its radius, and its rotation speed. So when an object changes in size, in the way that a star collapses down into a smaller object, the total amount of angular momentum possessed by that object is conserved. So a slowly rotating object that is large will collapse down to a more rapidly rotating object that is small. And the classical picture of this is the ballet dancer that brings their arms in to increase their rotation speed. So when matter falls into a black hole, in order to either form it or grow it, some of the properties of that matter that entered it is preserved. A black hole preserves information about the mass of the swallowed particles, their charge and their spin. Any other information is completely destroyed. So this makes black holes really, really simple. They can be characterized by these three properties alone. Now, black holes are smaller in size than neutron stars, which are in turn smaller in size than white dwarfs. Neutron stars are observed to spin up to around 700 times a second. We don't know how fast a neutron star can spin. If we find this out, we'll be able to say more about what they're made of, because the rotation exerts this outward force on an object, and there's going to be some critical limit beyond which the object can't hold itself together anymore and it'll just disintegrate. But black holes are expected to rotate a lot faster than neutron stars, up to thousands of rotations per second, so the order of kilohertz. Now, you can't really talk about black holes without the word event horizon kind of rolling off your tongue fairly shortly afterwards. Mm-hmm. So the horizon you see out of your window now, assuming you can see that far, is due to the curvature of the Earth, and your horizon is personal to you. If you move, your horizon moves. Yeah. It's a circle centred on you. Black hole horizons are fixed. They have no interest in you or where you are. So if you move, the horizon doesn't. And because of this, they divide events into two categories. So if you and a friend are both outside the horizon, you can talk to each other in principle over very long distances using light or whatever. But if you're both inside the horizon, any light, or indeed any information you try to pass between you, gets focused towards the centre of the black hole. Information can't travel between events easily, at least in an unconstrained way. And certainly information can't cross from the inside to the outside, and that's how we define a black hole. We can't see into the event horizon for this reason. Information about events occurring inside is focused inwards. It will never reach you if you're outside it. So a black hole is a perfectly rigid rotator, but similar to neutron stars, there's a critical amount of angular momentum above which the behaviour of the black hole, or at least its event horizon, will change. So as masses rotate, as large masses rotate, they drag the nearby space-time around them. This is an effect called frame dragging, and it means that the black hole itself causes the space-time at the event horizon, and indeed everywhere else, to have a rotational speed. So if the rotational speed of space-time near the event horizon is equal to the speed of light, that will disrupt the event horizon and leave behind what we call a naked singularity. So in principle, this means that information is able to cross the event horizon away from the black hole, allowing us to take measurements from within it. But that requires that the angular momentum is at or above this critical limit, which is probably not the case for most black holes, though it's probable that some of them are very near this limit. So the question I asked about measuring this spin, it isn't easy to do, but it is doable if you've got an X-ray telescope and a black hole X-ray binary. This is a binary system consisting of a black hole and a normal evolved star. Material from that star will be lifted from the envelope and will go into orbit around the black hole, where it will heat up. It will begin emitting X-rays, primarily from the presence of iron nuclei in the disk. And it turns out from Einstein's theory of relativity that the faster a black hole is able to spin, the closer the accreted material can get to it because the event horizon is smaller. And so one can measure how close the inner part of this accretion disk is to the black hole itself. And that gives you a proxy for the spin of the black hole. Also, the iron signatures that you look for will look different whether or not the material is orbiting in the same direction as the black hole is spinning, the so-called prograde rotation, or in the opposite direction to the black hole, so-called retrograde rotation. And just a little statistic, the supermassive black hole in the centre of the galaxy, NGC 1365, has been measured to be rotating at 84% the speed of light, which a pulsar or a neutron star certainly could not survive.
Well, thank you, Ben.
Okay, thank you.